Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
When your space has the long-lasting, noticeable scent of Airwick Vibrant Scented Oils, you'll want to invite everyone over, from book club to the fantasy league, even the in-laws.
It smells amazing.
Airwick Vibrant Scented Oils are infused with 2 times more natural essential oils versus regular Airwick scented oils for our most authentic, nature-inspired fragrance experience. Transform your space with scents like white sage and mahogany or lavender and water lily. Now that's a breath of fresh Airwick.
On? Hello?
We're all science people.
Science!
Exactly. Evolution does some pretty funky things.
There's chemistry in here. There's biology in here.
The old question in science is, how do you know that?
Achievement equals skill times effort.
That's the recipe for success.
I'm about to show you something so cool it'll blow your mind.
We can make the world better for everybody.
Starting now.
Welcome, welcome to Science Rules. I'm your host, Bill Nye. This is the show where science rules. It's a call-in show if you want to be on the show, and I hope you do. Leave us a voicemail at 201-472-0785, 201-472-0785, or go to askbillnye.com. You can check me out on all my socials, and you can find out who our upcoming guests will be, and you can leave us a question. Now, today, we are joined once again by science writer, editor, and dear friend, seriously, Corey S. Powell. Greetings, Corey.
Oh, Bill, it's always such fun being here with you. And now, Bill, you know me pretty well, right?
Sure I do.
Okay, what do I love in life nearly as much as I love my family and, of course, you?
Right. You like the, there's a word for it, end of the worldy stuff.
Oh yeah. The apocalypse. Eschatology.
Eschatology.
Eschatology. I like, death and destruction. And one of my favorite examples of death and destruction, real life death and destruction, of course, is the enormous asteroid impact that occurred 66 million years ago and caused crazy mayhem everywhere.
And it changed the world. You know,
it changed the history of life on Earth.
What do we say about kids of all ages? Two things, space and dinosaurs. And this is, you're in luck, Corey. You're in luck because we have space and dinosaurs and an expert. Our guest today is Professor Joanna Morgan. She's a professor of geophysics at Imperial College in London and winner of the Meteoritical Society's Behringer Award this year.
Meteoritical.
Meteoritical. So this has to do with the sky. And Behringer, by the way, is the family that owns Meteor Crater, Arizona, the Behringer Crater. So Professor Morgan. Oh, hi. Professor Morgan. Welcome to Science Rules. May I call you Joe?
Yes, absolutely. Very pleased to be here.
Thank you so much for taking the time. Now, you became very interested, some might say obsessed, with the with the impact crater off Chicxulub, Mexico, that is reasoned to be the thing that finished off the ancient dinosaurs. What, do you hate ancient dinosaurs? I mean, what's the thing?
Yeah, so why would I like this? So who could be interested in something quite as catastrophic as this? Yeah. An asteroid hit us. It changed the climate. It made us really cold and dark for years and years, and caused a mass extinction, 76% of species, including the dinosaurs. So, yeah, who could be interested in that event? So I've been interested for ages. I started in 1996, I think, when people had... They already knew about the asteroid had hit us, but they hadn't found the impact site until about 1990. And then people were arguing about how big this impact was and how big this crater was. And it was we couldn't really tell because it's buried beneath the surface. So if you walk along the Yucatan, it's absolutely flat. It looks like a subtropical sort of jungle, a flat sort of carbonate platform rocks. So it's buried about a kilometre beneath the surface of that area. And they were arguing, reason I got interested in is because I watched two people arguing about how big this impact was and how big this crater was. And one man said it was 170 kilometers in diameter, and another said it was 300 kilometers in diameter.
Wait, so it's two men arguing about how big their impact craters are? This is what got you interested?
Yeah, well, yes, partly. Yes, I see.
Well, when you put it that way.
I see your point there. And it was actually sort of a very intimidating sort of environment, because people, as they were having this very fierce debate, people were sort of shouting and booing and hissing. And I'd never heard anything like it, because, you know, scientists are usually pretty quiet and sort of quite polite. So it was a...
And plus, to an astronomer, 170 kilometers, 300 kilometers, what's the big deal?
Same order of magnitude.
Yeah, what? But that's one and a half.
So actually, you're right, it's not that big difference in terms of diameter, but it's actually a difference in times 10 in energy. So it is.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Okay, so there really was a big impact, so to speak, in this debate of just how extreme the effects were.
So what year was this, by the way, Joe?
Oh, where I went to this conference, about 1996, yeah.
Because when I was just graduated from university, people had speculated that the Chicxulub crater off of Mexico was a candidate. But yeah. You mentioned that it wasn't really decided until 1990, 7 or 8, 10 years
later. So it was presented as a candidate in 1991 in seriousness. And then there was quite a lot of argument about whether it was the big impact that produced this global ejecta layer that's how we first found.
Tell us about the global ejecta layer.
Okay, so everywhere around the world, you see a little thin layer of clay. It's a few millimeters thick, and it's full of it's got an extraterrestrial chemistry, so it's full of the asteroid basically, and you find that everywhere in the world. And then as you get closer to the Gulf of Mexico, that layer gets thicker and the particles in that layer get bigger. So you sort of know that you must be getting close to the impact site. So
when you say you find a layer of clay, it means you're a geologist who knows where to look.
So it's a very famous layer of clay because it separates the Mesozoic and Cenozoic eras.
Mesozoic means middle, and Cenozoic means recent. Is that
yeah,
right?
That's it.
And the word recent, that's another question. You know, you walk around minding your own business. Some people say it's 65 million years ago. Other people say it's 66
so
million
we have,
years ago.
Yeah, so we have changed the timing. When I first started, it was 65.5. And I think it was about 2 years ago they recalibrated and said 66.
Who's
yeah.
they? We thought you were they.
So the people dating it, their techniques have got better and better. So they use argon-argon dating. So they use ratios of argon-argon, and they've got better and better at doing that, and they've now got to 66.
I'm just picturing. So we're drilling down through these different rock layers, and yep. there's a sort of an upper layer, and these are the rocks of the Cenozoic, and then you hit this yep. clay, and this clay has extraterrestrial composition. It's something not of this earth. And then below
yes.
that is the Mesozoic. Mesozoic, at least when I was a kid, that was the age of reptiles, and Cenozoic is the age
right.
of mammals. So this
yeah.
this impact that you're talking about is the boundary line between a big transition of life on Earth.
That's right. So as 76% of species died, including all the dinosaurs, all the big things on land. And then after that, mammals sort of took off, birds took off, lots of things diversified.
So, Joe, when I was in first and second grade, Mrs. McGonigal, our teacher, read to us from a big book, and she said, the reason the ancient dinosaurs went extinct is because they had small brains. And so the mammals took all their food and the dinosaurs, ancient dinosaurs, went extinct. And even she knew that was just, no, that's lame. That cannot possibly be right. And so this mystery has been around for centuries. I mean, among human scientists, this mystery has confounded us. And I guess the question I want you to talk about, I think, is the size of this thing. You're telling me that a rock from space hit the Earth with such speed and carrying so much energy that it created a layer of dust in the Earth's atmosphere to shade the planet for weeks or months at a time. Is it true? I've I've heard Ed Liu, who's an astronaut who's very involved in keeping the Earth from getting hit with an asteroid, describe that the diameter of this cone of ejected material is bigger or about the same size as the diameter of the Earth. Is that right?
So I wouldn't quite describe it like that. So the ejector itself is quite a big diameter. So the sort of impact plume itself is about ends up about 1,000 kilometers high and a few hundred kilometers wide.
1,000 kilometers high. So
that's something
above
like that.
The,
yeah.
Above the troposphere.
Way up, yeah, the troposphere is 10 kilometers, so yeah, it's so way
station,
above the stratosphere.
Space station's at 450 kilometers. The LightSail 2 from the Planetary Society is at 710 kilometers. So you're way past all of that. That is a long way into the sky, peoples.
Yeah, so that's really, really high
thing.
Up. That's correct. Yeah.
Now, how do you do that calculation? How do you come up with that?
So you know how fast that plume expands, so you know how hot it is and how what pressure it gets to. So it's several thousand degrees centigrade shortly after it's the asteroids collided, and then materials being ejected at more than 10 kilometers per second, so it's moving up very rapidly.
So you say you know all that. How do you know all that?
So we can scale up, so we can see we see these things happen. And we can watch these things happen, and we can scale up to sort of to something the size of Chicxulub.
Okay, so first of all, you actually went on an expedition and measured it. So how big is this crater? You've answered your question, right?
So the first thing I did was I did a seismic experiment. So the reason people didn't know how big it was because they were using geophysical data that's not very accurate, so it's not really, doesn't resolve things very well. So it gave an ambiguous sort of answer.
So where do I get a geophysical datum? Where do I go? Is it a core from a ship? Is it a magnetometer from a helicopter?
So,
what is it?
So what we use is seismic exploration. So it's very much like the oil companies use when they're looking for oil, so oil reservoirs. So they're imaging the subsurface with seismic waves, basically.
Like so, pounding on the ground, setting off little explosions?
Yeah, maybe? So you can do that. We were doing it at sea, so we fire an air gun.
Release
air at high pressure.
Okay, so then how did you get your answer? And what is the answer? I'm dying to
get
the
answer,
number.
The answer is about 200 kilometers wide.
It's a pretty big crater.
It's quite big, yeah. So we do that by mapping the structure of the crater, and we can see where the crater rim is and what happens across the crater, map its structure.
And just to be clear, when you're seeing all of this, you're seeing the actual shape of all the melt and the reverberations, all the things that were happening 66 million years ago are still kind of frozen into the planet there?
Yeah, so it looks just like if you look on the moon, you can see craters. The middle of the crater looks just like Schrodinger. It's got this beautiful rings and a peak ring. So it's sort of topographic hill, ring of hills in the middle of the crater. So we can see craters on other planets, and then we can see our images, and we can sort of compare directly with that.
Is it true that people looking for oil found this thing first?
That's absolutely correct, yeah. So this was a gravity low, which means it should. So when you measure G acceleration due to gravity, it's a bit low above the crater because all the rocks are fractured. So they thought
that
it was
is
a deep.
Everybody, just think about that. These instruments are so sensitive; they can detect depressions in the Earth's crust by detecting the slight, ever so slight reduction
really
in gravity.
Really small change in it, you know, by a millionth of change in gravity. Yeah, so tiny.
A micro G,
right?
Yeah, that's it.
So
yeah.
Now all of this lets you reconstruct what was happening basically on that day when the asteroid hit. I'd love to understand, like, if I were a T-Rex hanging out in the Yucatan back then, would I even see the thing coming, or is it coming in so hot that I'm just vaporized before I even know what's going on there?
So it comes in fast. So it goes through the atmosphere in just a few seconds. If you happen to be looking in the right direction, you could just see it. So there is a possibility to see it before it comes in. If you were very close to the impact site, the first thing that would happen is you'd just be knocked over by the sort of excavation of this enormous cavity, a cavity that's...
And we say knocked over, I think you mean knocked over pretty hard.
Yeah, so it was a little push, yeah.
Yeah. This isn't like a T-Rex toppling on its side we're talking
about.
Yeah,
just having a little limp about, you know, a bit more than that.
I mean, the scale of it, you guys, phoop, and then everything is blown over and dead, like, immediately. Go ahead.
Yeah, so anything within 1,000 kilometers would get incinerated almost instantaneously.
So that's 10 hours of highway driving. If you're within 10 hours of highway driving, you are blown over and vaporized.
You were incinerated, yes, because...
Now, it's getting incinerated by a blast wave, or how is it getting incinerated?
So there's a vapor plume that's very hot, an impact plume that's rising up very quickly. The thing that I said goes to 1,000 kilometers high, and and that starts off as being opaque. So as it's first rising, this sort of big, buoyant mass of air, it's opaque. But at a certain critical temperature, it suddenly becomes transparent.
Okay. Whoa. It's so hot that light doesn't go through it?
It's a plasma initially, yes. So
it's sparking lightning mobile, and you can't see through it. Wow.
And then at some point, almost instantaneously, it becomes transparent and it emits all this thermal radiation. So it emits electromagnetic
heat.
Waves. Heat. Yeah, about 20 times the higher than the sun. So it's like having a second sun in the sky, basically.
Well, or like having 20 suns in the sky, it sounds
20
like.
Yes, the sun, but worse, yeah.
Wow. Okay,
So these are dinosaurs getting flash fried, basically?
Flash fried. Okay, that's within 1,000 kilometers. All right, now what if who are you? You're a velociraptor. We were extant in 66 million years ago, but we're on the other side of the world. We're in Mongolia. We're Mongolian velociraptors.
Okay.
We are not vaporized instantly. What happens to us?
No, you're not vaporized instantly, yes. So the first thing you'll note is seismic waves, which you may, if we're a bit like a truck running past, so you wouldn't be a really strong seismic wave by the time you've got to Mongolia.
And they probably had limited experience with trucks.
Yeah, they wouldn't have said, oh, that's a truck. Yeah, you're right.
But they didn't have much experience with asteroids either, so who knows?
So the next thing that you'd start seeing essentially the dust cloud coming up and coming towards you and going above you. So all the ejected material from the impact site and the asteroid forms into this fast-moving dust cloud that's traveling at about 50 to 100 kilometers above the Earth's surface. It's traveling at about 1 to 2 kilometers per second, and it goes all the way around the world in something like 2 to 3 hours, something like that. So a few hours after the impact, if you're in Mongolia, you would see it start to get dark, and it would get darker and darker.
In the modern world, if we did not have a pandemic, if I chose to fly to China, it'd take me from the west coast of the U.S., it would take me 10 hours, 12 hours to fly from Britain over the Great Circle. Is it 12, 15 hours? You're saying in 3 hours, this dust cloud gets from what is currently Mexico to what is currently Mongolia.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
Whoa. And it's held on the Earth's surface by gravity, or held near the Earth's surface by gravity. And comes around, and now what happens? I'm covered with dust. I am vaporized. What happens to me in Mongolia?
So it's obviously it gets dark.
Obviously it gets dark. So how thick is this cloud layer? How thick is this dust layer from a Mongolian velociraptor's point of view?
So basically, it's very thick. It's tens of kilometers, but of course, it's spread out. It's not sort of dense. It's like having this sort of 2 millimeters layer of clay, which is above you, so it still is taking out sort of something like 90% of the sun's radiation. So it's
dark. Now
so
what
it's
happens?
Pretty dark, yeah.
The dust settles, the iridium settles.
So the bigger particles come out more quickly. You'll probably see them then appear a little bit like meteors, so they would be sort of red sparks coming towards you. And the dust cloud itself stays up. We're not entirely sure, but it's anything from about a year to 14, 15 years.
A year? A dust cloud for a year?
Or maybe 15 years.
So this is because the particles are so fine that they don't they don't sink very quickly.
So that's what we know least well, is the exact distribution of the particle sizes. So
and meanwhile, a lot of the Earth is burning also.
Yeah, but that happens, that's not in the first few hours. So close to the impact site, we've got fires being ignited. And then sometime over the next few months, we've got probably global wildfires. So almost everywhere on Earth is set on fire at some point. So we can see that because there's so much soot in this clay layer, this funny clay layer, this extraterrestrial clay layer.
Why is it burning months later? That seems strangely delayed.
Yeah. So we've done lots of quite sophisticated models, and there's no particular way to ignite it straight away, but basically it gets dried partly by the radiation from the incoming injector. It's there sort of in these cold conditions, so it's not thriving anymore, it's not photosynthesizing. So you've got all this fairly unhealthy flora around the world that's not doing very well, and it's more susceptible to ignition. So it's just ignited by normal natural wildfires. We think there was a lot more storms, a lot more hurricanes, because of this sort of dramatic change to the Earth's climate.
Okay, so what happens in between? If you're near your Cory the Tyrannosaurus and you're near the Chicxulub impact, you're vaporized, you're incinerated, it's over in a moment. If you're a velociraptor in what is now China or Mongolia, it takes 3 or 4 hours for the sky to get extremely dark, and then I guess it gets very cold, and you can't find anything to eat, and in a few days you die over there. What happens if you're somewhere in between? You're in London right now.
So London was a lot closer than it is now, so because the Atlantic hadn't opened. So London, probably you would feel those earthquakes, and the earth would really move a little bit more. The dust cloud would reach you in about 30 minutes, perhaps 45 minutes. You might also get a blast, a sort of hurricane force wind. So the shock wave hasn't yet slowed down to normal sort of velocities. So when you move ejector through air at very high velocity, above the speed of sound, you produce these shock waves, and they turn into sort of high velocity like hurricane force winds that definitely reached as far as Canada, probably not quite as far as London.
Stick around for more science rules after this.
The South Dakota Stories, Volume 5. South Dakota seemed like the perfect place to unplug, but I ended up connecting to the world around me, a world where each sunset was painted, where I felt adventures pulse with every step, and where cold water trickling, pine swaying, and grunting bison became my favorite soundtracks. I just wish I didn't have to leave. There's so much South Dakota, so little time.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
Science Rules is back.
Now, there's a word you haven't mentioned, which I'm very curious about, and that's tsunamis. I'm thinking there must have been just these giant ocean waves going on too. Did that have an effect?
So certainly we could see lots of evidence for tsunamis. So we think a tsunami went the whole way up the western interior, all the way to Canada. So we can see that in the deposits and in the middle of America. You can see tsunamis. People have reported them in the North Sea, so right across the Atlantic.
When you say reported them in the North Sea, they've looked at the sediments and determined that there's like some sloshing, enormous sloshing.
They've determined they've got tsunami-like features, yes. So
are these ripples in the ocean floor and stuff like that?
So what do you tend to get, and then true in the western interior, is you tend to get seiches forms. So you get once you start a tsunami, you start to get some rocking about, standing waves in the water, so you can see that sort of thing. So the direction changes. You can see directional changes in the way the water's moving.
So hold on, you're talking about all this destruction, and you know this is a call-in show. We got a lot of questions about the destruction and the effects of destruction, and. Bill, what do you think? Should we bring in a voicemail from one of our callers?
Exactly, and I think we're going to love this first one because it's space okay. And dinosaurs. Let's roll that digital recording.
Hi, I'm Rose. I am 10 years old, and I'm from Vancouver, Canada. My question is, did the water dinosaurs die first or the land dinosaurs die first? Or did the sky dinosaurs die first in the mass extinction? Thank you, Bill Nye, and you're awesome.
Wow, Rose, I love you. I'm awesome, yeah. Corey.
And Joe, she didn't know that you were going to be here, but I'm sure she thinks that you're awesome as well.
Yeah, she must. So she uses these fabulous terms, water dinosaurs, land dinosaurs, or the sky dinosaurs. What happened?
Rose, that is such a brilliant question. I hardly know where to start. So where will we? I think anything close to the craters all dies at the same time. So it's all anything close by is pretty much instantaneous. What happens next? I mean, there is no consensus, to be honest. But so most people would say the strongest effect of this impact was the blocking of the sunlight, which reduced photosynthesis to almost nothing. So we lost the base of our food chain. We lost our plants on the land, and we lost our plankton in the sea. So, and everything obviously lives above that. So the things that eat things that eat things that eventually eat the plants or eat the plankton. We basically think the largest things like the dinosaurs died because they had the food chain was lost. So the things out a long way away from the impact site that weren't just affected by the hurricane force winds or the incineration by the impact plume, they probably starved to death.
So Rose, it was a drag. It was hard on everybody, whether you're a water dinosaur, a sky dinosaur, or a land dinosaur. It was all bad. The closer you were to this thing, the worse off you were. The sooner the dust cloud got to you, the worse off you were. Everything was bad really quickly. That is a cool question.
Speaking of, makes me think of our next question, which follows on very naturally.
Check this out. Roll that digital recording.
Hi, Bill and Corey. My question is, would it be considered extinction of dinosaurs if there's still animals in today's day that come from the dinosaur era? Thank you.
It's a cool question. I mean, you mentioned, 76% of the species died, but 24% made it through. Crocodiles are still here. Alligators are still here. All kinds of things. Somehow the bird or birdie dinosaurs made it through. How did anything survive? What you're describing sounds like the end of everything, but a lot survived.
A super question, because everything seems so bad, as you say. I think the idea is anything that can live off detritus, so not fresh living flora, plants and plankton. So things that can live off detritus, or they live off of things that live off detritus, were more likely to survive. Things that could hibernate were more likely to survive. Some of the reptiles could go down to quite cool conditions, so they were more likely to survive. Things that had seeds that could, so some things had cysts or seeds that could, stay there for a while until things got better. So, and most things that survived were smaller. So they need less food. They were less sort of dependent on a constant supply of food.
So here's the thing. Everybody of all ages is fascinated with this question. What happened to the ancient dinosaurs? It's so compelling. What got you excited about this? You're a geophysicist.
Geophysicist. So the first time I got into this, because I knew I was an expert in the technique that could solve the problem about crater size.
What made you an expert? Just a second. How did you become an expert in such a thing?
I did a PhD in seismology. So I did a geophysics degree and a PhD in seismology.
Okay, another thing for those of us on the outside. You're a geophysicist.
I am.
Which means you're not a physicist and you're not a geologist. So, Joe, what made you a geophysicist? What took you down this road?
So, geophysics has, you know, we just found out about plate tectonics. That helped us explain subduction zones, volcanoes, and all these things, so earthquakes. So it was a sort of exciting time for geophysics, in that you, by the time you got to your third or fourth year, you were learning things that had just happened in the press. So you were sort of, they were new, they were sort of hypotheses being developed. So it was a, it seemed like quite an exciting sort of field to pick.
So you got a bee in your bonnet about, here's this impact in the Yucatan that is associated, people think is associated with the demise of the dinosaurs. You wanted to understand this thing. And did you think at the time, oh, I need an expedition there. I need to go see this thing. I need to drill into this thing. What was your motivation? What was your process?
So firstly, to find out more about this crater. So to really, it still wasn't fully established that this was the crater that caused the mass extinction, the impact that caused the mass extinction. And then it sort of emerged to sort of other things that we didn't understand about cratering, so how craters formed. So when we drilled into the crater, we drilled into the rocks that had been fluidized, and they were amazing.
Wait, hold on. How do you do this? How do you? I feel like we're missing something here of like how you actually get to this crater and drill into this crater and understand this crater. You spent what, 20 years doing this?
Yeah. So there was 18 years in between me starting to study the crater and actually getting the drill and putting my proposal in to drill the crater and then actually drilling it. So that wasn't 18 years, I think. So you write a proposal, you have to get a scientific consensus, you go through lots of, you have to persuade, you know, the community that this is a really interesting, exciting proposal. You have to raise the funds. The funding is quite expensive. So the project took about $10 million to drill into this crater. So that's a whole years of drilling money. So, you know, it really has to be a very good, exciting proposal for the community and the people deciding on who gets the funding to decide to drill. We were sort of slightly lucky that the oil price dived in that it was going to be $20 million, and they were saying that's too expensive, and it sort of, because of the oil price dive, it ended up being about $10 million, and it made it just about affordable. So we had a bit of luck with that. We also added lots of sort of, when I first started, I was interested in the crater and how craters are formed and how you get ejected from the impact site all around the world, sort of that sort of thing. But then we realized that there was sort of a whole load of other objectives that we hadn't thought about, which was about life, basically. So people think life might have originated in impact craters. Here was a large impact crater.
You mean 3.8 billion
years ago. Yeah. So when we had lots of impacts, we had lots of crater basins. And this is a sort of big-ish impact, and it's pristine. It's all intact. So we've got the sediments that just above the crater that are still there now 66 million years later.
Why is it intact? It hasn't been weathering.
Underwater. Yeah. So the other two biggest craters have been extremely eroded. So and they've been tectonically deformed. So that you can't quite see the top.
What are the other two big craters?
So Sudbury in Canada and Redefort in South Africa. Those are the two biggest craters in the world that we know of. There will be more than that, but those are the ones we actually know.
When you say will, people will find them.
Yeah, so we've been...
You're not seeing one coming in right now, an asteroid.
No.
Yeah, because you would let us know if that were happening, right?
Yeah, I'll mention it.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so what point are you walking onto a boat and saying, okay, today we sail to the Chicxulub crater, we're going to go find some dinosaur remains. When did that happen?
So we drilled the crater in 2016, and that expedition took about 3 months in total. So the scientists were on themselves for about 11, 12 weeks.
And when you say drill, how many cores did you sample?
So we drilled continuously from about 500 meters below the surface to about 1350 meters below the surface. So we had core from 500 to 1350 meters, continuous core, about 6.5 inches wide.
And so how
much geologic time is that?
So we started at about 50 million years, and then we got through to the crater. The crater is got one date. It's 66 million years.
So how many places along the crater did you drill?
So we just drilled one. Because we could only afford one hole. So
that's what $10 million gets you, is one hole?
Yeah.
One hole, yes. It was a very nice hole, though. It turned out to be perfect.
How did you find the perfect place to drill? What were the criteria?
So we were trying to drill into this thing called a peak ring, this topographic ring of mountains in the middle of the crater, partly because that was close to the surface. So it's in the middle of the crater, but it's also was only 600 meters below the surface, so that was within reach.
Below the surface of the sea.
So the sea was only about 20 meters deep where we drilled.
Oh, so, that's where you can go scuba diving, right there, yeah.
Absolutely. And then we drilled in a sort of little valley where we were hoping to get sort of a nice sort of pristine section of rocks that were deposited above the crater immediately after the impact. And the point of that was to try and see how life returned into that crater, into the ocean basin, in the sort of months to years after the impact.
That sounds pretty quick. So you're saying that life actually, despite all this devastation, life bounced back in years, months, relatively short order there?
So right above the crater, we've got this 80 centimeter thick layer that's dark brown. And in that layer, we can see some life that was living in the years following the crater. It's not healthy, so the rocks are brown. The numbers of species in the rocks are quite small.
But this is right at ground zero, that life is bouncing back just in the next few years.
Yeah, so this was, we think, things that were brought back by the ocean resurge into the crater. So from some distance away, I think life was brought back into the crater, and it was able to survive.
Science Rules will be right back.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
You're listening to Science Rules.
You mentioned that craters like this might have actually helped create life on Earth, which is like maybe even one level bigger than wiping out some of the life on Earth. How would that work? And did you get any evidence about that from what you studied in the Yucatan?
So the idea there is that so these craters are hot. So we have a big superheated melt rock sort of inside the middle of the crater. So quite a thick sort of pile of pool of melt. The peak ring that we drilled into is really heavily fractured, so it's got a high porosity, so life can get into that bit. So we've got circulating ocean water circulating through those rocks.
Through warm rock.
Yeah, through warm rock, yeah, that's correct. So warm water circulating through warm rock, and we've got venting, just like at in the oceans, you've got hydrothermal vents right across the crater basin. That is quite cool, yeah. So we thought that would make it absolutely sterile and nothing would live. But what's living is actually 600 meters above the peak ring at the surface. So the plankton are sitting at the surface and they're still living. They're not being affected by all that below. But we also found microbes in the crater rocks, so actually in the crater itself, that are living now. So what we call a deep biosphere. So we found things living now, modern life in those rocks.
It fried all the dinosaurs, but it also sort of created this little microbial incubator?
Yeah, as far as we can tell, yeah. So, and that's a big surprise. So life came back really quickly into the crater, plus the life that's currently in the rocks, in the crater rocks, must have got there quite soon after the impact. They can't be put there now, it's too late. So those microbes have sat there evolving for the last 66 million years, and they're still alive in the crater.
Wow.
So could that be how life began on Earth? Is that really what you're saying?
So the idea is really that it is possible for life to survive in these big impact basins, even though you've got these very hot impact craters and hot water circulating. It seems to show that it's not impossible for life to appear. It would be slightly different. It would be thermophilic life, so it would be stuff life like in Yellowstone.
Thermophilic, heat-loving life.
Heat-loving life, yeah. It would be like that, yeah.
And they, you know, there's microbes that live in this almost boiling water, and then in the deep ocean vents, it's way above surface boiling. The water, the pressure keeps the water from boiling. And there's enormous ecosystems that thrive. It's freaking amazing. So look, are you concerned about another asteroid impact?
I'm sure we will be hit by, I mean, we know we're hit by meteors all the time. So we know we get something like 15,000 tons of meteoritic material arrives on Earth every year. So it's constant. You know, we had 20-meter-ish type meteors come through and cause some sort of devastation. Tunguska sort of flattened a forest. So we know it's going to happen. Fortunately, one this size happens every 100 million years. So we're pretty hopeful it's not going to be as big as this. But it is a worry.
At the Planetary Society, we like to joke that there's no evidence that the ancient dinosaurs had a space program. But we do. So if we were thoughtfully thinkful and found one of these things with our name, with the Earth's name on it, we would do something about it. We'd build some sort of spacecraft or system to give it a nudge to keep us from getting a hit. Now, when this event happened 66 million years ago, this thing comes through the sky and it created these shock waves in the air. This might lead to lightning, which would lead to what, Corey?
Which would lead to a lightning round. Is that the lightning that ignited the global forest fires 66
yes.
million years ago?
Either that, it was recorded in a recent thunderstorm. So it's time.
Either way, it's time for the lightning round.
Dr. Morgan, it's time for the lightning round. Okay, here we go. What is the most painful thing? What is the most serious thing that happens in an asteroid impact?
Oh, so the radiation from the impact plume, so that's
gets you. The sky, the air gets so hot you can't see through it. That's amazing. Okay, where would you want to be? Where would you want to be during a big impact?
I'd like to be on the moon.
Ah, there you go. With wearing, dressed properly.
Right, and you'd have an incredible view. That actually probably would be amazing
absolutely.
To watch.
Absolutely. Yeah,
If it's lined
if you're
up.
You're on the right side.
All right, and so you say you haven't studied many other mass extinctions, but you have an interest. If you could study another one, what mass extinction event would you want to study?
Oh, probably the Permo-Triassic. That's the one that killed 96%.
That's everyone knows that's the best mass extinction. I mean,
it's
got to
be the best.
So only 4% of the living things on Earth made it through that? And what caused it?
So that was volcanic eruptions, Siberian traps, and they went through some coal seams. So there was large masses of carbon dioxide and methane released. So the Earth got a lot hotter. So that was actually runaway sort of greenhouse sort of took a lot more million years than this one. But yeah, so
all right.
Runaway greenhouse.
All right. Now, if you got a dinosaur named after you, what dinosaur would it be? You got any ideas there?
Oh, something vegetarian? I'm a vegetarian.
All right. Okay.
It's very peaceful of you.
Very peaceful.
Maybe a nice little hadrosaur type dinosaur or something like that.
All right. So, in your opinion, what are the chances of this happening again?
So, it definitely will happen again. It's just a matter of when.
So, any day now, any century now.
Any 100 million years now.
It could be tomorrow. It could be 100 million years. Yeah,
nothing
we don't
to
know.
Worry about. Plenty to worry about. Now, are there lessons to be learned? This is probably not lightning. This is more a week long drizzle. It's more of a kind of a London weather question. Are there lessons?
It's a fog question.
Are there lessons to be learned about climate change from this impact, the 66 million years ago?
I think the sort of the thing that's most terrifying about climate change now is it's happening so fast. So if we look at how we got the extinctions in the past that were due to global warming, they happened really slowly. But what we're doing now is faster than anything we've ever done in history. So the way the carbon dioxide is going up is faster than any series of volcanic eruptions. So it's the scary thing is how fast it's happening.
even though many people perceive it happening in slow motion.
Yeah, many people don't seem to think it's hot.
There you go. But it is. Everybody, this has been the most fun ever. I mean, this, we have space and dinosaurs. We have inferring extraordinary information from having the process of science to discover what happened with this crater off the what
and we have incandescent plumes of rock 20 times brighter than the sun, flash frying a global distribution of dinosaurs,
turning rocks to
dinosaur
liquid.
Barbecue. Come on,
turning rocks to liquid in an instant and killing a lot of things except our ancestors.
1,000 kilometer radius dinosaur barbecue flash fry.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Our guest today has been Professor Jo Morgan. She's professor of geophysics at Imperial College London and winner of the Meteoritical Society's Barringer Award this year for her understanding of what happened that killed off the ancient dinosaurs. What a fantastic day. Thank you so much, Jo, for being our guest. It's just cool.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed myself. Thank you.
When it comes to understanding a fiery mass extinction side of the universe, everybody, remember,
science rules.
And if you like Science Rules, and I hope you do, please take a moment to rate and review it in Apple Podcasts and on Stitcher. It helps us out, helps other people learn about the show, and helps us learn what you want to learn about. So thank you. Be sure to look at my socials for more information on our upcoming guests. I'm at Bill Nye on everything. Meanwhile, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, I hope you do, give us a call at 201-472-0785 or submit your question to everybody's homepage, askbillnye.com. Science Rules is produced by Harry Huggins and our very own Corey S. Powell.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Casey Hallford mixed this episode and composed our original theme. Josephine Martirana is our executive producer. Chris Bannon is the CCO, the chief content officer at Stitcher. And at Stitcher, everyone,
science rules.
Stitcher. Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.